Hello, I'm Tony Collins, and this is the Rugby Reloading podcast. Only this week, it's Rugby Reloading Plus. And I'm very pleased to say that I've got as my guest today, Tim Robey, former Super League referee, National Rugby League referee, columnist in 4020 magazine, and a whole host of other things, as hopefully we'll find out. So, welcome to the podcast, Tim. Thanks for agreeing to do it. First of all, the obvious question, how did he get into refereeing?
Yeah, thanks for having me. My background in the game was coming from a bit of a strong family history in rugby league, but a bit of a lapsed family history as well. So I rediscovered the game kind of on behalf of my family at about in my teens, really. And I had a great uncle who played for Great Britain and a family who did love the game for a long time, but had kind of drifted away from it. And then I got into watching it.
Sorry to interrupt. Who was your uncle?
Yeah, Johnny Stopford, who played for Swindon.
Oh, really? Yeah. I'm old enough to remember him playing just at the end of his career.
Yeah, right, okay, yeah. So, it's not widely known. And then I guess I was part of, like, the Sky Sports generation of finding the game that way, really. And then I played for a number of years and, you know, wasn't the biggest player, wasn't the toughest player, but like to think of myself as kind of a smarter player on the field. And I think that kind of lent itself to learning about loopholes in the rules and how we could kind of, you know, think about things that I was doing on the field. And it somehow led to refereeing. And I did the two simultaneously for a few years. And as a lot of referees face, when I got to kind of 16, 18 years old, you really have to make a choice about which path you want to pursue. And that's when refereeing started to get more serious for me.
So am I right in thinking you did a philosophy degree?
Yeah, so I moved to York at 18, went to the University of York and studied philosophy and politics there, and somehow managed to keep going effectively as a part-time referee and climbing up the ranks for 3 years while I was living in York and studying philosophy by day and training and refereeing by night usually.
One of the things that interests me is to what extent you think your philosophy training has influenced you as a referee, because there's a kind of link between refereeing is not straightforward, is it? You can't simply apply the letter of the law. There's always a bit of grey area where you have to make decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. Inside and out of the game, you know, the immediate response I usually get is a raised eyebrow that the two things are opposites. And I like to try to argue quite strongly that there's a lot more in common than people realise. I mean, one of the things I'd written about in one of my columns not long ago is how I really think you can treat a game of rugby and refereeing a game of rugby almost a lot like you interpret a text in literary studies, right? You have it has a start and it has an end. It has a narrative that builds during. It has a context of history between the sides, what's happened in the first minute, what's happened in the 10th minute, the score, the time. And they're all the kind of skills in a different way that I use when I did studies in literature as well, or studies in the theory of literature, philosophy. And the crux of it is that refereeing is about being able to handle kind of grey situations and dealing with context. The biggest misconception is that we're kind of dealing with black and white facts on the field and this is right, this is wrong, because some of the job is that, you know, whether you get a knock on correct or not. But the majority of what we do and the real skill in the job is all about managing situations of context and knowing when to insert yourself into a game and all sorts of questions of justice. And, you know, I like to describe it that we're kind of the executive, the judiciary and the legislature all kind of put into one within the field of sport.
Well, that's generally not a very good thing, is it?
There's possibly
certainly not in politics anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a possibility of a bit of tyranny there, but we're kept to a pretty high level of scrutiny, both within the referees and from the outside, which protects against that. But yeah, I think it would help us both within referees and on the outside if people, I think, could see refereeing as a bit more widely. And, you know, philosophy is a kind of a highbrow way of putting it, but it's like any other field in life, and even like interpreting players and philosophy of sport generally. There's a whole grey feel to it, which makes a very interesting thought around the topic.
I think it's interesting from a historical point of view as well, because one of the issues that came up in the split in the 1890s was about interpretation of the rules. And one of the things that the Northern clubs who went on to form the Rugby League were very keen on was a literal interpretation of the rules, both on and off the field, because they felt that the rugby authorities, the RFU, were more interested in the spirit of the law. And this was true both in terms of the way the referees interpreted the law on the pitch, but also off the field as well. So the Northern clubs thought that the amateur regulations weren't properly administered because some people were felt to be outside the law. And it's interesting, switching codes slightly, it's interesting in rugby union, for a very long time, they believed that the job of the referee was just to, it wasn't literal interpretation of the laws. It was about the spirit of the laws. And that seems to be, that still seems to be the case very much now in terms of, well, kind of what you said in terms of the context of should we let the game flow even though there's been some kind of potential violation of the rule?
Yeah, I think as soon as you say the word interpretation, that's the key of it. And again, I often come back to the point that there is no removing interpretation from what we do. There's such a thing as too much interpretation and getting away from, you know, what is actually happening. And that sounds a little bit like, you know, maybe what's happened in the history of the union side of things where, you know, if referees are given total license to interpret the spirit of the game as they see fit, then you're going to go to one extreme where things are too subjective or, you know, we get away from actually applying the laws. But I mean, it's a dialectic really between the two extremes. If you then have the other extreme, then just like police and society, you would never get a game to begin with if we tried to pull up every infringement. So that dividing line between interpreting, between having a feel for management and then applying the hard and fast laws, that divide runs right through the middle of officiating in general. And that doesn't matter. I imagine that doesn't matter which sport you're talking about and absolutely applies to our sport. And I think it's about finding the balance between the two. If either side of that balance gets too powerful, then the game suffers.
How has that been affected by two referees in Australia? I mean, as I'm sure you're aware, it's been discussed about bringing it into Super League in 2020. And you've experienced both systems. On the face of it, it would seem that that interpretation becomes slightly more difficult when you've got two referees on the field. How do you cope with that?
And what it definitely does is it creates more accuracy and it creates more consistency. So, for example, we have a much bigger referee squad here. Immediately, you've obviously doubled the number of referees in any round of games in first grade. So you absolutely create the pressure to be consistent between us is raised massively. And an extra pair of eyes on the field just increases accuracy. And, you know, in an age where we have slow motion video and the kind of demands, the stakes that teams are playing for, we aren't really going to get away from the demand for that kind of accuracy. And obviously we hear calls for consistency a lot. But yeah, in terms of that interpretation, the flip side of that is probably that we do get away from the kind of old school individualized character of different referees doing it in a different style, people managing the games as they see fit. So yeah, I mean, two referees will definitely lend itself to higher accuracy, consistency, and it's a general more kind of technocratic style of refereeing, which is probably what's called for in our age of televised sport. But for better and for worse, what you do get away from is the kind of, you know, the old anecdotes of individual referees who really had a lot more leeway with how they interpreted a game.
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly, particularly the 70s and 80s, up to the 70s and 80s, every referee appears to have been completely different. And teams would adjust their play according to the referee. Both in Britain and Australia. Speaking of the contrast between Britain and Australia, obviously you've been in Australia what now for 3 years, two, 3 years?
Going on 4 years actually. Almost 4 years. I can almost apply for citizenship soon. Actually, yeah.
One of the main differences or similarities between the culture of rugby league in Britain and Australia, because I think one of the things that it's quite difficult to appreciate for people is the nuances between, because there's obviously lots of similarities. But the nuances, the differences are quite interesting.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that really stood out to me that I quickly learned here that I was quite naive about. So, I mean, I very much took on the kind of league identity growing up in my teens and as a young adult in the UK how league can almost be a really strong subculture at times, like a tribal identity and a very politicized identity. So my entrance to the game was really kind of, whether you call it rediscovering family roots, regional roots. And it was always inseparable from a kind of politicized idea of, you know, the game's place in society and in the north of England at home. And, you know, the whole kind of consciousness of bias in the general media or, you know, the coverage of the game and that kind of thing. Whereas what I immediately found here is, you know, the game's a lot bigger in Sydney and in New South Wales and Queensland. And as a result of that, it takes on more of the profile that, you know, we'd kind of see in football at home, in soccer. So people in general are obviously, everybody's more aware of the game, of the big names, and it has that kind of bigger profile in general. So, you know, you hear a lot more about it, you see a lot more about it. But yeah, there's definitely less, in my experience, there's a bit less of a sense of belonging to a small group who are, you know, how Lee can sometimes have that kind of almost like a missionary feel at home.
It's almost a political party, isn't it?
Yeah. And I definitely felt a difference with that. And yeah, just the whole kind of socioeconomic class dynamics are very different here. And I was very naive to that.
What about just in terms of the way the game is perceived within Sydney, but in Australia in general? How does that differ?
Yeah, so without contradicting what I just said about the game's obviously much bigger here. And yeah, I probably had this idea that I get to Sydney and everyone's going to love the NRL and everyone's going to have a team. And obviously it's much more popular and it's very widespread. But you do also come across a hostility at times to the game, which is stronger than I probably experienced at home. And it's very much a kind of, I'd say, a class-based thing here. So there's the best comparison would probably be the kind of sneering attitude towards overpaid Premier League footballers and all that kind of cliche.
Yeah.
In the UK, and yeah, people are very ready to jump on the kind of bandwagon about player misbehavior, scandals, that kind of thing. And without, you know, not trying to advocate that kind of thing, but there's definitely a willingness to use those kind of things as a way to look down on the game as a kind of low class thing. Yeah, and there is a kind of hostility in certain kind of gentrified sections of Sydney towards you know, the stereotype of a league fan.
Yeah, I think that's certainly from my experience of visiting Sydney. I found it, the hostility to rugby league in certain parts of Australia is far greater than anything in Britain, which I suspect, partly it's because rugby league's big, but on the other hand, I think it does serve as a kind of, it's a bit of a metaphor for class prejudices.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's not completely foreign when I think to things at home. That it's not a dissimilar experience to what I had when I went to uni, for example. And the paradox in it that I always found is a lot of people who are well-educated people at university in the UK who would generally describe themselves as a kind of liberal, left-leaning, well, progressive in politics. And yet, when it comes to sport, there's a real contradiction there, because more often than not, these would be the people who pull out a Six Nations jersey once a year and were kind of sneering of league in a different way, not about off-field behaviour, because there isn't that knowledge back in the UK, but there's an inability or an unwillingness to link the political identity of league as this kind of, you know, originally a working class, revolutionary class identity with general progressive politics now. And that happens at university in the UK with people who aren't from the north. And it happens especially here with your kind of classic inner city cosmopolitan, you know, maybe green voting left liberal, who actually doesn't seem to me to what I think is the right thing to put two and two together of league's, you know, inherently kind of progressive identity. But with this, kind of class snobbery as well, it's a really curious paradox.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's certainly my experience as well. Continuing slightly on that theme, one of the interesting things you wrote about, maybe the last or last but one issue of 4020, was attending the Currie Knockout competition, the Aboriginal Rugby League competition. Can you tell us something about that and what your impressions of that were, and also the role of Aboriginal people within Rugby League?
Yeah, that was a really great experience in my first year here that I was fortunate enough to be able to do. So the Currie Knockout is a statewide New South Wales Indigenous Knockout Carnival of League, and I believe it's the single biggest gathering of Indigenous Australians, full stop, not even in sport or rugby league, just all together.
Really?
So, you know, that immediately tells you something about the crossover between social or political identity or communal identity with the sport here. And look, I'm no expert, and there are people here who would know a lot more about it. But as an outsider, especially a couple of times when I've been to that carnival, which was kind of 9 hours driving land from Sydney, and a couple of other visits I've done to some of the really small country towns, which, look, they have a history of segregation, effectively. And, you know, to this day, you still kind of see that there are inequalities and there are divides that need to be overcome. But it's really significant how league stands out as one of the few things that seems to have brought people together. And so there's that element. And there's also just the simple thing that, you know, growing up in the north, and you kind of, league has this familiarity of belonging to the post-industrial towns in the north of England. And then I bridged out to France a little bit, and I was fascinated to see that there are these towns in the south of France with this league identity woven into them. And then you bridge out again, and you see I don't want to use the word exotic, really, but you see that there's this whole other, you know, there are these really different instantiations of where league has taken root that really denies that identity we sometimes get fed, that it's you know, one-dimensional game in a very locked-in regional identity, because it's amazing to see the really different places that it's taken root. And these small country towns where the Aboriginal presence is really strong, and especially in the game, and yeah, small places that have sent way above their, punched way above their weight in terms of sending players through to play first grade in Sydney and even the UK, is really interesting and quite inspiring as well.
I think the, one of the intriguing things is the fact that there's a universalism to it. The ideas of the Northern Union, that everybody should be allowed to play the game they choose, where, you know, regardless of what your background is, what colour, what class, whatever. That's actually a compelling message. So you do, as you say, you find it in villages in the south of France, in country towns in New South Wales. And I think in a lot of that ways, the game doesn't make enough of.
The diversity of league across its, across its limited places, but the diversity within that range is really great. And possibly more than other sports that are bigger on the surface of it. And it kind of reminds me of a point really away from sport, actually, about, I've seen a documentary about Northern Seoul, for example, and, you know, and in working class Wigan and Northern towns, and how there'd been this crossover, this conduction between, you know, black music from underprivileged places in the US that had suddenly found root in working class industrial towns in the north of England. And it's almost a bit similar how as I think you've said before, it's always places that are underprivileged or kind of fighting anti-establishment, and that's where the game's taking root. And you see these really diverse areas, but you suddenly see similarities that you wouldn't have picked out without the common denominator of rugby league.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's this point that that rugby league's never been the game of a ruling class anywhere, which I think is quite interesting from a sporting point of view, because it's not possible to really say that of any other similar type of sport.
I do wish sometimes we'd take on a bit of a stronger identity as the kind of, you know, rebel sport like that, but that's probably a whole other topic, really.
I'm sure we'll have to. Well, in fact, because as I'm strictly keeping to 20 minutes, we've already overrun. However, I'm sure we're going to have a second part of this. I shall wind up by saying thanks very much. This is absolutely fantastic. Really enjoyed talking, and I hope people listening do. I hope people listening have enjoyed this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my name is Collins at Tony. And Tim, I think you're at Ref Roby?
Yes, at Ref Roby on Twitter.
At Ref Roby on Twitter. And if you want to dig a bit deeper into the history of rugby and the other football codes, take a look at my Rugby Reloaded website at www.rugbyreloaded.com. Until next week, thanks for listening.